Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. BP, the one-time British Petroleum, says it's working around the clock to find a fix to the spilling oil in the Gulf of Mexico. But on day 34 and counting, they've yet to deliver a solution or even a real assessment of the seafloor gusher's volume. And from the Coast Guard straight up to the White House, it has often seemed like the U.S. government and BP are hand in hand. That's infuriating many who claim that empty rhetoric and positioning are masking incompetence or worse, a cover-up. This hour on Point, America's oil spill nightmare, the challenge in the Gulf of Mexico, and the public trust. You can join the conversation. Are we getting the whole story? And has everything been done that could be done to stop this spill? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear in a moment from one of the top scientists who has called BP out on its estimates of the scale of the spill, and from oceanographer Sylvia Earle. Joining me right now from Garrison, New York, is Andrew Revkin. He writes the Dot Earth blog at the New York Times, where he was environment reporter for 15 years. He's also a senior fellow at Pace University's Academy for Applied Environmental Sciences. Andy Revkin, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
It's good to be with you.
Top kill maybe tomorrow. They want to put in a plug and cap this somehow, and we just heard them in the news saying maybe 6 or 7 in 10 chance of this actually working. Do you think it's still going to be gushing 24 hours from now, Andy?
Yeah, I do. In fact, the latest word was that this might not happen until Wednesday or so. And it is very iffy. The technical challenges of doing anything 5,000 feet under the ocean are daunting. And I've been trying to get from BP and the government a list of the things that will come if this doesn't work. There's been some hints about next steps, but there really hasn't been much of a sense of what could happen if this doesn't work.
There's the talk again of the junk shot, the golf balls and tire shards.
Yeah. Well,
is that a joke or could it work? Could you get it
well,
in
John,
that?
John Stewart saw it as a joke. It could work. You can clog the apparatus such that the flow slows down or stops. But the pressures are enormous. This technique has worked in shallow depths before, but never been tried at this depth. And there is growing sense that somehow or other a broader array of expertise needs to be brought in. And the Obama administration swears that it's got every possible intellectual resource working with BP on this, although the question does still come down to who's in charge.
There's been this strange feeling as it unfolds in this horrible slow motion that somehow there's posturing going on here, and the appearance of transparency but not the fact. And then last week we heard the CEO of BP, Tony Hayward, predicting minimal environmental fallout from the spill, even as over the weekend we saw the governor of Louisiana, Bobby Jindal, kind of, standing in the muck. Here's the BP CEO just last week on Sky News.
I think the environmental impact of this disaster is likely to have been very, very modest. It's impossible to say, and we will mount, as part of the aftermath, a very detailed environmental assessment as we go forward. We're going to do that with some of the science institutions in the US. But everything we can see at the moment suggests that the overall environmental impact of this will be very, very modest. I think will be seen as a textbook example of how to do an emergency response.
Andrew Revkin, help us get some perspective on this. There's the BP CEO saying very, very modest environmental impact and a textbook example of how to do an emergency response. Pick those two up, Andy.
Oh, my God. Well, again, from the standpoint of the politicians standing on the shores around the Gulf, dreading the bigger impacts, let alone what's already come ashore, it's just absurd to hear a CEO of the company, and particularly when there's no clarification yet on the extent of the oil flow. This could go on for months. It could be another 2 or 3 months before the relief wells are drilled, which are kind of the final backstop to stopping the flow. So he's presuming, Hayward is presuming, Well, I don't know what he's presuming. And you throw a hurricane into the mix to spread the oil around more in the, I don't know.
Which we could well have in August. The relief well, now this would go down to the oil, to the sea floor and then several thousand feet more and try and intersect this this drill shaft, as I understand, and block it.
Yeah, they're trying to, they're drilling two of them to try to kind of come in way down deep below any breaks in the well up higher to stanch, to choke it off at the base. And this, everything here is kind of being done to a level that's new. If you have three more months of discharge at the current rate, to say anything about that is very, very modest, is patently absurd. Now, if it depends on how you define environmental impacts. If you mean actual dead fish, that's different than saying despoiled beaches that can't really be swimmed on, or the economic impact of closed fisheries is different. You know, maybe he's just parsing in a legal way what he means by environmental impact. But
that's exactly what we're wondering about, is the parsing. I mean, is it possible that we've got, I mean, it was disaster and then catastrophe over the weekend. I heard cataclysm, but right in front of our eyes. And meanwhile, we're being sort of given a kind of theater about the scale of it for corporate interests, for, you know, to guard their flank on the legal front. Is that possible?
Well, you know, one thing I've been writing for since May 1st on the blog is whether BP is in a position to be trusted, given that it's operating in the interests of its shareholders, as all companies do, and to take the public interest as its first priority here. And just today, just over the weekend, just in case anyone wonders who actually has responsibility in a situation like this, and I'm just about to finish a blog post on this. A lawyer at NRDC, Natural Resources Defense Council, posted the wording of the section of the Clean Water Act and the Oil Pollution Act, which basically says this is Obama's responsibility. The president shall direct, and doesn't say should, could, may, all federal, state, and private actions to remove, discharge, or mitigate the threat of discharge when you have a major spill. So it's like...
But that's not happening.
Well, no, there's a hot potato aspect to this situation. It's easier politically to point the finger at BP and stay slightly to the side. And even over the weekend, administration officials were kind of, or federal officials were kind of offering mixed statements about this. Thad Allen, Admiral Allen of the Coast Guard, was saying there's all kinds of oversight, but it's still BP's job. And then Ken Salazar, the Interior Secretary, was saying that the government should be prepared to push BP out of the way, particularly if the top kill, this midweek effort this week, doesn't come to fruition.
Kind of mixed messages, and meanwhile the oil flows on and on and on. A lot of doubt expressed in Congress. Barbara Boxer called it a cover-up going on in the Gulf of Mexico. Here's Congressman Ed Markey, Democrat out of Massachusetts, chair of the House Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming, talking with reporters last week about BP's response.
We're beginning to understand that we cannot trust BP. People do not trust the experts any longer. BP has lost all credibility. Now the decisions will have to be made by others, because it's clear that they have been hiding the actual consequences of this spill.
Let's get to the experts. Andrew Revkin already gets us down that road. He's with the New York Times right now from West Lafayette, Indiana. We're joined by Steve Worley. He's a fluid dynamics expert, professor of mechanical engineering at Purdue University. He's been right in the middle of the scientific critique of the estimates of volume of oil flowing out of this blowout, this gusher at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, a big op-ed piece that he had along with a number of other scientists in the New York Times on Saturday. Steve Worley, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We heard 5,000 barrels a day, 5,000 barrels a day, day after day after day. But your estimates have been much higher. Where do they stand now?
Well, where things stand now is that I and several other experts, made these estimates based on a video that was released. Let's see, that would be around 10 days ago. So it was the Thursday before last.
Belatedly.
Yes. And so within, I think, 24 hours of that video becoming public, and I should mention that's the first look that the general public had at what's going on down on the bottom of the ocean. Within 24 hours of that video being released, we had three university professors, independent scientists, all working independent of each other, come up with estimates that were considerably in excess of the 5,000 barrel a day number. And to give you an idea of the range, Tim Crone from Lamont Doherty Labs, he came up with a number of 20 to 100,000 barrels per day. And independently, Eugene Chang from UC Berkeley came up with the same exact range. And my range was right around 70,000 barrels per day, plus or minus 20%, which makes 56 to 84,000.
So we're talking here 10 or even 20 times as much oil as BP was saying. BP has said that's not what matters. What matters is stopping this. What do you say to that perspective, Steve?
Well, certainly, I mean, the first priority is plugging the hole. We've definitely got to stop the oil from leaking into the Gulf. However, you know, that said, the issue of how much oil is leaking into the Gulf is certainly, you know, at the forefront here. And for two reasons. First of all, the scientists who predict where the oil is going, you know, the loop current and all of that, they have very complicated ocean models that show how the oil is going to be carried around in the Gulf of Mexico and beyond. And the inputs to those models require knowing the flow, how much oil are you putting in on a daily basis.
Do you see a cover-up here, Steve?
I can't say. I mean, you know, I could conjecture that I think they're... I could conjecture that they're not revealing everything.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Gulf oil spill challenge, whether BP's blowing it, how we'll ever meet it, whether there's been a cover-up, incompetence, calculated obfuscation, what is going on in the Gulf of Mexico, and how do we get a handle on it. Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal talking with reporters after taking a boat around the state's coastline last week. Here he is after surveying oil washing onto marshlands and beaches.
The oil is here. You know, for weeks now, people have been talking about whether the oil was going to come, what kind of oil was going to come, what impact it was going to have. Let's be clear, the oil is here. We're not talking just tar balls. We're not talking about just emulsified oil. We're not talking about sheen. We're talking about heavy oil is here on Louisiana's coast.
Heavy oil on the coast, and now we've all seen it. Here's Ken Salazar, Interior Secretary, talking to reporters in Houston yesterday, saying that the government will take over from BP if necessary. No details yet.
If we find that they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing, we'll push them out of the way appropriately, and we'll move forward to make sure that everything is being done to protect the people of the Gulf Coast, the ecological values of the Gulf Coast, and the values of the American people.
Andrew Revkin of the New York Times joins us today. Steve Worley is here. He's in the professor of mechanical engineering at Purdue University, right in the middle of all the analysis of that video that BP finally released, and coming up along with other scientists with much higher estimates of the volume of oil headed into the Gulf. We're joined right now as well, and we're happy to have her back with us, by the renowned oceanographer Sylvia Earle. She's explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society. She has been right at the middle in previous years of big spills, Exxon Valdez, you name it, former chief scientist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. You can link to her nonprofit Mission Blue at our website, onpointradio.org. Sylvia Earle, welcome back. Thank you very much for being here.
Great to be on board.
But everybody seems to be at sea. You've said it's baffling that we don't know how much oil is being spilled. Why don't we know?
Well, I think thanks to Steve Worley and some of his colleagues, we do know. At least we have a better idea than otherwise would be the case.
And why don't we know from BP? I mean, they're in charge of this wellhead.
Well, there are ways to measure, as we have heard and had demonstrated, and now even BP is saying that the 5,000 barrel figure was low. So it's frustrating, to say the least.
What do you think of the BP CEO saying that it will be a very, very modest environmental impact that we'll end up with here?
Well, he may be thinking in terms of dollars and cents, but he's not thinking like an ocean certainly not speaking for the fish or the other creatures out there who are now not just trying to cope or not with this spill of oil, but the dispersants that have been added, making a real toxic brew. Those dispersants should simply be stopped.
As I understand, they have been stopped, or at least the sort of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of gallons of that family of dispersants that were outlawed years ago in the U.K. I think, Andrew Revkin, they've stopped that that vein of dispersant going on?
Well, you know, my main focus has been on the seabed well question, and I've left – there are other reporters at the Times who are pursuing right. questions about the dispersant, so I can't really knowledgeably weigh in on that.
I think that one dispersant at least has been stopped. Is there evidence yet, or will we be studying this for years, for decades, Sylvia Earle, about the impact of what's already gone in?
The impact on the organisms that are less conspicuous than the oiled birds and nearshore life where most people are concentrated. But the point is that most life that's being affected is out there in the ocean itself, and it's not just at the surface, especially with the use and application of dispersants, and particularly applying them right at the wellhead, something that
5,000 feet down.
Right. It appears that when the hot oil comes shooting out of the hole, comes in contact with cold water, that it doesn't behave in the same way that oil that is released at the surface in the kind of spill that we've seen in the past. Most spills that we that make headlines or have made headlines in recent decades have been associated with the shipping of oil,
mm-hmm.
or you know, ships like the Exxon Valdez hit rocks and their load disperses over the surface of the sea, and some of it ultimately sinks and gets mixed up, especially again when dispersants are used to force the breakup of the oil and make the little droplets smaller, which in turn makes it more accessible to the small organisms that drive the way the ocean works. I think about, for example, mm-hmm. the fish that feed low on the food chain, things such as the menhaden that are the middlemen for a host of other creatures that cannot access the plankton directly. They rely on the other fish, the small ones, to do the grazing, and then they eat the fish
mm-hmm.
that
sure.
have done that and accumulate whatever's in the small fish and so on up the food chain. But some, like manta rays and whale sharks, do feed directly on the plankton. And the whale sharks, in particular, right there at the surface. The Gulf has a population of whale sharks that aren't on the balance sheet of most of the people who are evaluating the environmental impact, but they're part of what makes the system work. They need to be counted. They need to be taken into consideration. We're putting the focus on the coastal areas, but the real problems, in addition to the problems that happen when the oil comes ashore, are out there in the ocean itself. And because this is a deep gusher of oil, it is getting into the water column. And some observations have been made, but not enough. We need to have scientists, observers, divers out there with submersibles, with remotely operated vehicles, with just diving under the slick itself to see what is going on and to be able to track where this oil goes.
If this goes on until August, I mean, let's hope and pray that this top kill maneuver later this week, we're told, works. But if it doesn't, the oil gushes on until a relief well hits it in August. Or who knows if that will even work if it goes on further. But let's just say August. How do you picture the damage from this endless gusher in the Gulf, Sophie?
Well, I take it on a day-by-day basis. What's been done already is by no means is this minimal impact. This is something that if we look at the whole three-dimensional realm that is the ocean, not just the
mm-hmm,
coast,
mm-hmm.
not just beachfront property, but the ocean, this has taken a bite out of what keeps the ocean alive, if you will. Now, looking back to the Ixtoc spill of 1979, so far, the present spill, even given the increased estimates of the volume, haven't come to be as great as Ixtoc. But if this goes on for another few weeks, it will not just match it, but exceed it. That took 9 months, and the aftermath of that was a number of things. Depressed populations, certainly in the near term, of many organisms that were looked at by scientists, including those at the Heart Research Institute, now at the Heart Research Institute in Corpus Christi, Texas, Texas A&M, and others who tracked the impact. And the good news is that at least 30 years ago, when the ocean and especially the Gulf of Mexico was in better shape than it is today, did recover. It did respond, not perfectly. It will never be the same as it was pre-spill. These events do take their toll, just as hurricanes do. But here, the lingering poisons in the system and their lethal and sublethal effects on populations, it's true with the Exxon Valdez. You know, you go there today and you might say, well, what problem? But if you measure the impact on the populations of otters, of herring, of the whole suite of life, not just the more conspicuous creatures, then you see that it's an enduring impact, and it's not small. It's not small if you think like an ocean.
Andrew, if you think like an ocean, there's a thought in itself. Andrew Revkin, what speaking of the suite of life, what about the suite of options here? Is there a sense that everything possible has been considered, or has BP, you know, been trying to, I don't know, guard the value of the well long term so it can come back for the oil? Or are there options on the table or near it or that should be on the table that haven't been put there for stopping this?
Well, frankly, I think we don't know. There's the government, just yesterday on CNN, Admiral Thad Allen was pressed pretty hard by Candy Crowley on this point. And he swears that, you know, the Sandia National Labs and John Holdren, the very able science advisor to the president, are peppering BP with questions on every possible option. But back on May 1st, I wrote a piece on .earth essentially asking the question, is there a Feynman fix for this? Are we really thinking outside the box being conventional oil company responses?
Feynman as in big thinking physicist kind of
response. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Looking at a problem from an unvarnished, unfiltered stance, using all the intellectual expertise we have in hydraulics, geology, deep sea engineering. You know, the Navy has huge capacity, much of which may be classified on what they can do in the deep. And Sylvia has a lot of experience in those some of the technological possibilities, at least for getting around down there. And we don't really know. You know, there was this description of a room with pizza boxes being slid under the door, but I don't understand why it's not a more open.
In other words, a kind of a bunker where people are trying to figure out answers here. We've got listeners thinking about exactly this angle. Mm-hmm. Let's go to some of them. Eric, Southbridge, Massachusetts. Eric, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, I talked to your screener about two things. First of all, understanding the magnitude of this spill, if you look up close, if you look at the gusher and if you look at birds with oil on it, this really skates over the real disaster and what it is. If you had 100,000 barrels per day, which is way outside the estimates of most people.
But not outside the estimates of the scientists writing in the New York Times just 2 days ago, Eric.
Well, but, you know, whatever it is, these are the starting numbers, and you can make adjustments based upon that. In 30 days, you'd wind up with one ten-thousandth of a cubic mile, which is a hell of a lot of oil. But it's one part in 5.8 billion of the Gulf. So we're talking about, that. Now, I'm not saying that that's a small amount of oil. My guess is that there's a way to stop this that should have been done earlier. And here's my – and
like
I
what?
Think well, there are two things. First of all, a bunker buster very deep.
Exactly.
Under the well, and second, the backup is, if that doesn't do it, nuke it. Now, I can almost guarantee that this has been discussed by the U.S. and the Soviet Union. because the Soviets wouldn't be happy if we started setting off nukes, but Putin has actually suggested it. There was a little note on the BBC, and that means it's probably being discussed. And so if the top cap doesn't work, then a bunker buster is next, then a nuke. And a nuke would stop it for sure.
Well, let's look at the bomb path here. Andy Rivkin, first to you. People are talking about it. They're writing and blogging about it. I even read that Russians have done it years ago.
With gas wells, yeah. The key thing here, though, is the politics. A nuclear weapon will not be used. It just won't happen. And now there are, and I wrote this back on May 1st, and the Feynman post that the military has huge experience, and industry does as well, with using munitions as engineering tools, essentially, and crimping a pipe, even 5,000 feet under the sea, in the seabed under a mile deep of ocean, is doable. And it may not be politically doable, because if it doesn't work, you know, then you have this real big sense of, oh my God, we really blew it. Now, the chances of it, there's been some talk of, well, if you do that, you'll threaten to release far more oil. I've talked to a bunch of engineers about this, including some working in the industry, and they say there's no chance of that, because the pressures of the rock, once you've done a concussion down there, will all sort of push inward, and not the oil itself, the deposit of oil is 3 or 4 miles farther down under the earth, so it's not like you're going to suddenly create some unmitigated oil outflow.
Just a complete blowout. We'll ask Sylvia Earle, but Steve Worley, you're our fluid dynamics guy. What about a bunker buster? What about a bomb as an answer to the problem here?
Yeah, that's a good question, one in which I don't have direct experience. I mean, basically, if you can somehow disrupt the straw, the pipe to the surface of the ocean, you can seal off the well. But whether, you know, what level of munitions would be required to accomplish that, I can't say.
Sylvia, have you thought about this, looked at it? What are your thoughts?
Well, again, what are the consequences to the ocean of any such action? Yes, stopping the oil is a desirable thing. That would seem to be at the far end of last resorts. I, again, have no experience with the dynamics involved here. But you would like to think that how to stop a problem would have been addressed long before the drilling began. And it obviously wasn't taken as seriously as it should have been. But given that we now have the problem, I hope there's a softer, kinder solution than throwing a nuke at it.
And a nuke wouldn't be the only kind of bomb, but I realize these are terrible trade-offs, but if you describe the destruction to the marine world, to the ocean itself, if the oil goes on and on, that's hardly appealing in itself. I mean, people are going to get desperate pretty soon, aren't they, Sylvia? If this top kill doesn't work this week and we're looking at maybe August for maybe a relief well intersecting this thing?
Well, among other damaging activities, putting dispersants in the ocean should be stopped now because it's adding poison. Oil is basically a natural substance. There are creatures, microbes, that are adapted to it and can, over time, do the biological, natural mitigation of the oil itself. But these chemicals that are synthetic, that are not found in nature, are harder to accommodate. Now, the effects of a major explosion of some sort, I mean, it could work, but again, there's the uncertainty. Will it do the job? We don't really know.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Gulf oil spill challenge, whether BP's blowing it, how we'll ever meet this challenge, whether there's been a cover-up, incompetence, calculated obfuscation, or the full and best effort that could possibly be put forward with Sylvia Earle, renowned oceanographer, former chief scientist for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Steve Worley is with us. He's a fluid dynamics expert, professor of mechanical engineering at Purdue University. He's been right in the middle of the effort to get a better grip on what the volume of oil coming out of the floor in the Gulf of Mexico is. Andrew Revkin is here. He writes the Dot Earth blog at the New York Times. He's been covering the environment for years and years. Let's get to our callers. William, Spartanburg, South Carolina. William, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. Really frustrated with our government for not providing more information to the public with regards to the magnitude of this disaster. I've been following the hearings on C-SPAN, 4 hours of hearings I've watched.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also watched Press Secretary Robert Gibbons field calls from the press, and it is almost as if the government speaks that we are overseeing this, and it is the legal and technical responsibility of BP to bring this to a closure. And when Lamar Kay is pressed with very difficult questions, particularly regarding dispersants, he always points to the Environmental Protection Agency and Unified Command as the people, which essentially is the government, who are directing their guidance. So there's a back and forth between the government and BP in terms of, you know, who's hailing what and what information is being released.
William, I think you're reading this pretty well, and Andrew Revkin, I think our caller, puts his finger right on it. There seems to be this play, this gap in between the two, kind of, you know, President Obama said he was disappointed with, what do you call it, a ridiculous display when the oil execs were trying to pass blame, but there's some kind of play left, it feels to me, in the gears here between BP and the government where oil flows.
Yeah, well, and I wrote about that last week. He was complaining about finger-pointing, but he was doing the same thing. He was just pointing his finger there. And again, in about 10 minutes, I'll have a post up on the blog with the clear language from the Clean Water Act as amended in 1990 under the Oil Pollution Act.
On responsibility.
The job is the White House's job. It is the responsibility of the president to act. You know, less than a week ago, we had a story in the Times quoting Thad Allen, the Coast Guard commandant, who's a great guy. I've written on his work in other mm-hmm. realms, talking about there's a door and everyone's behind the door and they're sliding pizza boxes in and no one gets out until they come up with the solution. But the whole process, there's been too many doors. I think this needs to be much more transparent. It's not like a classified operation, and so why not engage fully the intellectual and technological capacity to get this fixed, and kind of keeping the doors shut and having just perpetuates the kind of fog that the listener was alluding to.
But why not? Is it keeping legal deniability? Is it keeping political egg off people's faces?
Well, my guess is it's a mix. There are legal issues. There's no question about culpability and financial responsibility. But the politics of this is really the ugliest thing, because no president wants to take ownership of a situation with an uncertain outcome. You know, whether this happened even when I was covering the climate talks in Copenhagen, it was amazing that Obama was willing to go there with no clear outcome, which maybe implies, in this case, he has the instincts that would allow him to come into a situation that's implicitly ugly. He did it in Copenhagen, kind of helped cobble something there, however incomplete, and maybe here, but it has to come from the top. The law sort of mandates it.
But the law says so, and ultimately that oil on the beach, Sylvia Earle's thinking about the whole ocean, but people see the beach, at least when BP is not running the cameras off. Here's White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs yesterday on Face the Nation, CBS, facing questions. Bob Schieffer asked the sort of dread question.
Do you think this could be your administration's Katrina?
Well, I think if you look back at what happened in Katrina, the government wasn't there to respond to what was happening. That, quite frankly, was the problem. I think the difference in this case is We were there immediately. We have been there ever since. Thad Allen is directing our response as the National Incident Commander. There are people on the ground. There are thousands of people working, even as we speak, Bob, to figure out a way to plug this hole and to deal with the spread of this oil.
And yet, it rolls on, and people are staring straight at this and everybody's role. Carl in Oakland, Iowa. Carl, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me. I have spent some time in industries actually on the surface that are large consumers of oil. And every one of them requires a spill prevention, control, and countermeasure program for all their tanks that dike up and contain at least 110% of the total volume of the tank.
But isn't that the problem, Carl, with offshore drilling? Because you can't just dike up around it. You're in the middle of the ocean. If it spills...
My point is the government, for the simplest of spills to capture, contain, and basically eradicate or ameliorate, has very extreme degrees of regulation in place and has had for decades.
On land?
Decades. Yes. Now, in the ocean, you have new technologies, and you have new problems, and you have, because of the sheer volume of oil that's potentially capturable and obtainable, you have extreme potential hazards like we're looking at right now in the ocean. The benthos probably never will recover deep down in the ocean. Surface creatures, you can expect mass exterminations on a local basis of some of the most endangered species in the Gulf. You can expect all sorts of things to come of this, and yet the government has done nothing but collect money from these people in terms of regulating the safety and the requirements for reaction to potential spills should the safety measures not work. They should have pre-positioned that giant structure that they tried to drop down over the well. That should have been manufactured. It should have been tested. It should have been pre-positioned someplace in an advanced launching point so that they could go in and capture this stuff.
Do it fast and do it effectively. Carl, let me take that to Steve Worley. You're our fluid dynamics guy, Steve. I mean, could something have been – we know the blowout preventer was down there, and it didn't work. What do you make of that, first of all? And then is there a backup to the backup? What is it? Could have, should have? What could have been done here?
Well, I agree with Carl that that BP was not prepared to respond to this immediately. In particular, I mean, we saw the containment dome is what they call it, the four-story concrete structure that they lowered on top of the well in the hopes of containing all of the oil that was coming out of the well. And it backfired for reasons that testing would have revealed. So I think that idea was not fully tested and should have been.
Why is it so hard to stop this? I think a lot of people look at it and think, you know, why can't you just drop a big rock on it or something? You know fluid better than any of us, Steve. I mean, we saw that you had the methane and ice that formed when they tried to put that big dome on things, but is it the heat? Is it the pressure of the oil that's spewing out into the ocean? What makes it so apparently profoundly difficult?
Well, I suppose it's a combination of pressure and flow. So the pressure of this reservoir is tremendous, thousands of PSI, tens of thousands of PSI. And so when we drill down and puncture a hole into it, it deflates like a balloon. The pressure that's in the well is what's pushing the oil out, which means it'll go on its own, right? And so from a oil company's point of view, that's nice. You pierce the well and start collecting the oil that comes out
Eureka.
Of the end of the pipe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. But it also means that you have to be ready to shut things down, to have methods ready to go to shut things down. And this is a challenging environment, a very deep well. So the methods that they could use to shut it down aren't the same methods that would work in a couple hundred feet of water. However, that said, for instance, this containment dome, what happened was it filled up with these hydrates, which is essentially methane combined with water to form a slush or an ice, which is less dense than seawater, filled up the containment dome, and it tipped over, basically.
Right.
So it's not a complicated engineering problem. You make the containment dome heavier, and it sits on top without tipping over. But it seems like it wasn't completely tested.
We don't have that dome, and the oil goes on. Sylvia Earle, you heard one of our callers earlier who identified himself as a physicist doing his back-of-the-envelope calculation and thinking, well, even if it were 100,000 barrels a day going on for 30 days, you still have a very dilute oil-infused Gulf of Mexico. What do you say to that, Sylvia?
The solution to pollution is not dilution, and it isn't spread equally throughout the Gulf. It is a big body of water. It is resilient. Nature will heal to some extent, but there will be a bite. There is a bite now being taken out of the systems that make the Gulf of Mexico what it is. It's not just rocks and water out there. It's life that makes the Gulf, the ninth largest body of water in the world, function, doing things that we take for granted, delivering oxygen to the atmosphere, grabbing carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, driving the great ocean food webs, just maintaining the planet on a steady course. That's what the ocean does. And we have, in a stroke, destabilized the systems that are the underpinning of not just the life support systems for the whales and the birds and the fish, but for us, too. We're all in this together.
What do you see when it comes to transparency on the public front here, Sylvia Earle? I mean, what the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration had shipped the Pelican out there. They came back and talked about oil droplets and plumes.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't seem like we're getting, are we getting full transparency from NOAA even?
I think NOAA is communicating as much as they have available to them, but BP clearly is not. They've been resistant to transparency, starting with, let's find out how much oil is flowing into the Gulf. They should want to know. They probably do know, certainly better than the original estimate of 5,000 barrels a day. This is necessary to size the problem, so that even in terms of the use of dispersants, it seems to me that that was misguided in the first place, but secondly, if they are going to use dispersants, you should figure out, well, how much to deal with a problem of what size. The whole application, the business of trying to make the problem seem to go away by breaking the oil up into smaller drops and making it essentially look as though it has disappeared is not a solution, not even for the coastal areas where you've added toxins to what already the oil is doing to the not just the conspicuous wildlife, but to the inconspicuous parts of the system that are the base of food chains and all the rest.
Yeah, that sense of an effort to camouflage and disguise the weight of it is really unsettling. Let's get a call from John in Streetsboro, Ohio. John, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I wanted to call in. I have a solution for this, a device I had patented about 10 years ago, and unfortunately, until something like this happens, no one's interested in it. I have contacted BP on the computer on their suggestion line.
Yeah, you and thousands of others. Any response?
So far, I haven't gotten a response other than having sent me a form. But this has been tested. It does have three U.S. patents on it, and I've modified it now for this particular situation.
And you think it would work? You got something that would work down there that would stop even this big leak?
Yes, yes. That's not a problem. Everyone's looking at so many different things. I can't believe some of what I've heard blow up the bottom of the Gulf. But the thing is what you have to do is you have to stop the flow of the oil coming out. At the same time, you have to stop the flow of the ocean trying to push down into the pipe.
Mm-hmm.
My product does both. It uses environmentally friendly chemicals. They start off as a liquid, and they harden very rapidly. They're as strong as steel when they're set up. We've tested this, taken this chemical and caused this reaction.
So heads up, BP, John, and a lot of other people pouring those suggestions into the suggestion box at BP. Andrew Rifkin, how are you reading this ultimately? Evasion of long-term responsibility? Could BP be thinking, well, if we can just stop it, then we can argue about how much came out. But as long as we don't measure it too carefully while it's still flowing, no one will be able to prove how much has come out.
I think they're trying very hard to stop the flow. I've been very critical of BP in the last couple of weeks on Dot Earth, but last year I wrote about their remarkable accomplishments in stopping methane leaks, a really big contributor to global warming from oil and gas facilities. So I know the people there are hardworking. They have great technical expertise. Mm. But I still do. What I worry is that they're not acting with the they're not simply stating the question, how do we stop this flow most reliably, most quickly? They're thinking about it in the box of how a company thinks, not the box of what would need to happen to protect the public interest in this case in the best way. And that's why, again, going back to the law, I think it's time for the administration to take on the real responsibility, and it's ugly and uncertain, to lead this effort with BP, of course, involved and probably doing most of the work. But
would that be the Navy? Are we talking about then? I mean,
could well be, sure. Yeah. Yeah. You know, the Coast Guard is not their response people. They're not act to solve a problem people. There's plenty of capacity within the Navy and the federal labs, and to at least. And maybe they're in the room. Maybe they're in that room with the pizza boxes being slid under the door. But
maybe so. Yeah. We haven't learned that yet. We'll be looking there. Andrew Rifkin with the New York Times, Sylvia Earle, and Steve Weberly, Worley at Purdue. Thanks to each of you for being here. This is On Point. Mm-hmm.